It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The U.S. economy is seeing wage growth and inflation is cooling, but some Wisconsin food banks report increasing need in their communities and longer lines. More than 500,000 Wisconsinites face hunger, including over 200,000 children. That's according to Feeding America. We check in now on hunger relief efforts in different parts of the state. Debbie Holzkamp is a volunteer with the Lakeland Pantry in Arborvitae near Minocqua that serves the greater Northwoods area. Debbie, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
And Rochelle Gamoff is here, founder and executive director of the Waukesha-based nonprofit Friends with Food. Rochelle, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Rochelle, let's start with you. How much need are you seeing in your community outside Milwaukee? What is changing?
We see our lines getting extremely long, and families that have never needed food in their life seeking out food from a food pantry. So we see a lot of children now. I think our children is up to 37% of our guests. And so with the cost of healthcare, housing, and all the other essentials, families are putting food on credit cards. And the need is just extremely increased.
Is this surprising you? Because you started this nonprofit in the pandemic when there were great needs that you saw around you. What is changing here?
Well, and, you know, I had a family that came in for the first time. It was a mother and daughter last week, and they were very reluctant to come into our doors just because they, you know, they were down to the last food in their cupboards, and they were trying to use every other resource possible before they walked into a food pantry. And they came in, and you can just tell that they were just feeling defeated. At Friends of Food, we change more than just the food needs of them. We help them through the process to create a sense of normalcy and dignity and empowerment. So we're doing a lot more other resources than just our pantry as well.
I'm going to turn to you, Debbie. What are you seeing in the North Woods?
Yeah, so year over year, there's been a 30% increase in demand for supplemental food, and partly due to inflation and economic challenges. And one third of our local full-time residents in Oneida and Vilas live at or below 200% of the federal poverty level. That's $40,000 or less annual income for a household of two. And up here, nearly 50% of our population is over 50, the age of 50, which is 7% higher than the national average. And also I want to point out that census estimates do show that the households at or below 200% of the poverty level actually rose by 17% from in 2023 compared to 2022. So we serve 35% of our clients are 50 and older. And also 30% of our clients are children under 18.
With your clients who are aging, do they have difficulty getting the services and things that they need to sustain their life?
Absolutely. It is a big challenge. We cover 6,300 square miles, and it makes it difficult for clients with limited transportation or just can't afford the cost of transportation. And so And then we have weather that affect, the economics and also the ability to actually get food. So it's difficult. We also struggle with a third of that population, 50 and older, are disabled. So those are our challenges for sure.
Rochelle, back to you. There may be a misconception that an affluent community still has needs for food. When you look at census survey data, there are parts of Waukesha County that are much more affluent compared to the rest of Wisconsin. Why do you think a community like yours still has this very much a growing need for food?
I think Waukesha County has a stigmatism of being like the richest county in our area. but the need is still there. And there is so many folks that are still like struggling. We're seeing like 92% of our audience that does qualify for that it falls below the state poverty line. So we're seeing a lot of increases, and our struggles are really getting the food and rescuing more food because the demand is so high. We're struggling to get the great sources that we need for food for our guests.
Who are your partners in that as you have difficulty keeping enough food stocked and ready to meet the need?
Our number one source is Feeding America, but within the state budget last year, it was cut. And so if you can just imagine, we were at a 50% increase from last year. The year before, we're at a 223% increase in the amount of our guests that visit our pantry. So we're seeing like records increase still keeping up, yet a shortage of food because the whole state budget was cut for purchasing food for Feeding America and Hunger Task Force. So we're not getting the food that we used to get last year.
Debbie, how about Lakeland Pantry? Have there been difficulties keeping enough food stocked?
Yes. We're basically serving 13% of those in need, and we need to serve a lot more. And at the same time, food prices are projected to increase by 9% this next year. So it just makes it even more difficult to serve our current clientele and continue to outreach to more people who need supplemental food and necessity.
We are talking with leaders from Wisconsin Food Banks about the growing need they're seeing in their communities. Debbie Holzkamp there from Lakeland Pantry in Arborvita near Minocqua, and Rochelle Gamoff is from Friends with Food in Waukesha. Rochelle, how well do different social service groups work together, collaborate in your community to tackle these issues? What kind of overlap is there?
We don't know who actually visits other pantries because there's two major ones in our area in the city of Waukesha, but we serve like the entire southeast Wisconsin area. So anyone can come and see us from different counties as well. So we are experiencing such a huge growth span. Our needs are really kind of expanding our facility so we can keep up with the demand.
And Debbie, you do some of the grant writing for Lakeland Pantry. How much do you have to go to outside of your service area to secure resources?
Well, actually, we have an urgent need to do that these days. We don't have nearly enough external grant and government funding, and our goal is to increase those donations by 25% to meet the current need that we serve and also to really do the outreach and serve a whole lot more people in need.
But the federal government provides assistance through the Emergency Food Assistance Program. What impact is federal funding having in your community on the clients you work with at the local level?
Well, again, most of our funding comes from local donations, sponsors, a strong collaboration with local schools, churches. Like we do an outreach backpack program with Ascension Lutheran Church, providing weekly backpacks to 150 elementary and high school students so they don't go hungry over the weekend. All of that is really, local collaboration. We have very little direct government support.
Rochelle, with the holiday season, that can tend to drive people to be generous to local food banks. It's top of mind. How do you try to maintain that kind of support year-round with food donations and volunteer participation?
We encourage our area companies around us to do food drives, make it fun with their employees, or come and volunteer as a big group as well. So we're trying to get that interaction more with the companies to help us fund. We don't do any purchasing of any supplies or groceries that we're not receiving. So it's really our grant writing. I think we wrote over 385,000 in grants, and we probably got less than 1% of that because it's very competitive out there right now. So I would urge anyone to support local food pantries in Wisconsin, because the food banks, we've had to rescue more food than we ever had. So we're spending more of our resources rescuing food. So we're just needing a lot more funding so that we can keep up with demand.
Debbie, Lakeland Pantry doesn't include the word food in the title. What kind of resources do you provide to the community beyond just food?
We offer clothing, shoes, baby supplies, diapers, pet food, cat and dog food, reading materials, books. And then we also have volunteer nurses from Howard Young Medical Center and retired nurses with current professional licenses, and they provide health screenings like blood pressure and blood sugar checks and referrals and nutritional consultation. And then, like I said before, we do a lot of partnership programs with our community. So we have pantry hubs, on-demand pantry hubs in hospitals, churches, police stations, and community organizations. And for example, we'll deliver on-demand over 10,000 pounds of food this year.
So really trying to make it that one-stop shop in a way.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Debbie go ahead.
I would just say, and we just need a lot more help on awareness and donations. Donations for sure. I think that's what you're hearing. We need that help.
Debbie and Rochelle, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experiences.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much, Kate. Thank you.
Debbie Holzkamp, volunteer with Lakeland Pantry in Arborvitae near Minocqua, serving the greater Northwoods area, and Rochelle Gamma, founder and executive director of the Waukesha-based Friends with Food. They are with us to share the need for food, what they're seeing rising in their communities. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, find out how veterans dealing with PTSD and other mental health challenges are getting help from horses in Wisconsin.
I trusted the horse first because, first of all, it didn't want nothing from me. It wasn't going to use me. It wasn't going to throw me on a bus.
Equine therapy for Wisconsin veterans, that's coming up next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Yesterday was Veterans Day, and for veterans, the transition back to civilian life can be challenging. Support is available through different veterans associations, nonprofits, and other veteran-focused organizations. In the Eau Claire area, Wisconsin veterans have the opportunity to seek out a specialized form of therapy, working with horses. John Serafin is a Wisconsin veteran who retired from the Army after 29 years of service. He graduated from the Veterans Equine Program at Trinity Equestrian Center in Eau Claire, where he is now a board member. And Tony Mattson is co-founder, owner, and program director at Trinity Equestrian Center. She was John's equine specialist when he took part in the program. They talked with Rob Ferrett yesterday.
I want to start with the basics on the Trinity Equestrian Center. In general, what kind of services are you offering to veterans and others?
We, for 22 years now, we have been working with veterans and youth and families and survivors of trauma. And connections, relationship, and trust is what we have found has been really, really our strong suit. And we work with youth development and counseling. We partner with our amazing horses. And we just, John can speak to that, but we meet people right where they're at.
Before we bring John into the conversation, Tony, I've heard this from other people. There's something almost magical, it seems like, about working with horses. And I think it's one of those if you know kind of things. But tell us, what is it about horses that makes it such a potentially therapeutic experience?
Well, it's my opinion that it has to do with their heart. One of their biggest motivations as a creature is to connect and they will do nearly anything to do that. And they can spot someone who is struggling emotionally a mile away. They can read us like a book, whether we like that or not. But for us as a therapy team, that's one of our greatest tools and why we choose them as our partners. But it's also to do with their size. They are imposing animals, even our little guys. We have horses that are as small as a large Great Dane, all the way up to, 1,800-pound animals. And it doesn't matter their size. Their heart is the same. Their first goal really is to connect with humans. And that's what is so irresistible to those who have struggled, particularly, trauma survivors and really, really particularly with veterans, because veterans come back and they struggle with trust. That's one of their big things. And they don't trust the humans. But in short order, because of the heart of the horse and they're seeking that connection, they trust the horse far faster than they do the human team. And there's just no fooling a horse. They cut to the chase. They see right through you. And that is a marvelous tool for us because we humans can't do that. But part of the job, I'm one of our equine specialists. I'm dual certified. And my job was always reading the horse and relaying what I'm seeing to my teammate who is a Wisconsin licensed therapist. Sometimes people think that our equine therapy is a riding, is actually a mounted form, and that kind of is a standoff sort of feel to them. We don't ride. It's all on the ground. It is, like I love saying, it's nose to nose and shoulder to shoulder. That's where the relationship is born and grown, and it grows into this most amazing relationship and connection. And that's, like I say, that's where all the healing starts.
John, you are one of the veterans who's been through this program as we mark Veterans Day. Thanks to you and any veterans listening right now for your service. Can you tell us a little bit about your time in the military and leading up to your retirement?
Oh, sure. I joined in 1982. I was wounded. I was in an explosion in a Desert Storm. And right after Desert Storm, of course, back then, we didn't have a name on it. PTSD, we didn't know it was IEDs back then, nothing like that. So I was involved in an explosion. I was going through my third failed marriage. and so the military, I grew up in the military since the age of 17. That's what I knew. I always had a purpose. My episodes, I guess you could call them, or whatever, my rage, everything started happening probably 92, 93. And I never had an answer for it, where this all was coming from. And I'm not talking about getting angry. I'm talking about pure straight up rage, just rage. It would build up and the little things would just build up. And I never had an answer for it. I was always scared. So over the years, you kind of learn the ticking of the bomb. And then for some days, I was too scared to drink. So I would just ride it out. It'd be like three days sometimes of no sleep, just adrenaline rush after adrenaline rush. And then once I got calmed down, because I was too afraid to drink, sometimes it was all you could do just to hang on. And you never wanted to hurt nobody. It was in my head, I don't want to hurt nobody. So you push everybody away. And everybody on the outside looking in thinks you're a freaking fanatic, just thinks you're crazy, And then I was getting closer and closer to retiring. I got diagnosed in 2008. I was out in Oklahoma. I received a letter from the Army saying, hey, you might have PTSD. So I went to a psychiatrist they set me up with on a Friday afternoon. I went in there and she asked me all these questions. Early childhood, the incident and everything that happened. Then it was about an hour, hour and a half. And she said, have a nice day. And I went home and I bounced off the walls all weekend. It was crazy, but I finally had a name. It was called PTSD. So I was diagnosed with PTSD. So I had a name. So then I started doing a lot of research. So I retired in 2011. All of a sudden, everything that I had, my identity, my purpose, and everything was gone. So, and then I retired here in January, so that's not a good thing to do because it was really cold and I was stationed in Oklahoma. So depression hit, a lot more drinking, of course, because I didn't think nothing of it. And then I was on my third marriage, my failed marriage, and then I got hooked up with Trinity. And I had tried regular counseling, and I always try to find the good because there's always something good. Always. I contemplated suicide one time, ended up, spent a week up in a mental ward. Never want to do that again. But you just get so tired. And I'm not talking tired like I work so hard tired, just tired of the fight every single day and every minute of the day. Sometimes you're fighting for minutes. A good day, you'd fight for hours, you know. You just get so tired of it and you just want it over with. And so when I finally got in Trinity, I didn't trust nobody. No, I got burned by a lot of people throughout the years. So I didn't trust nobody, didn't expect nothing from nobody. Even though on the outside looking good, you know, I could talk to people. But inside, yeah, I was just a hermit. And then it took me a while. I did trust the horse first. I'd never been around horses before. I trusted the horse first because, first of all, it didn't want nothing from me. It wasn't going to use me. It wasn't going to throw me on a bus. It was just there, like I was just there. So that was one common thing we had. And then I couldn't intimidate it. So I couldn't push it around if I didn't want to talk. I couldn't push it around. I couldn't scare it away. I couldn't push it away. So then I had to confront my fears, you know, with this horse. And horse never judged me. Didn't call me names. So the bond with the horse started first, and then it took a while. I would probably say a good 6 months, 8 months before I started even trusting Sylvia. Sylvia was my human counselor, I guess you call him. And then Tony was my equine therapist. And that was my team that saved my life. So then I started trusting them.
Wow.
Then the work began, you know.
Then the work began. John, let's pick it up there. You've met horses kind of for the first time. You've learned to trust them. You're learning to trust the people with them. Now, what does that work like once you'd established that as your baseline?
As a baseline? Well, you go in and it's I never knew what we were going to do, which was okay. You know, we'd go in the arena and they would talk and they would think of just different exercises, you know. Like, for instance, one exercise, they told me to draw my world as a circle, and it was pretty freaking small, okay? Real small. And they put a thing of oats, and I guess that's like candy to a horse. And so sometimes I would have one horse, sometimes I would have two horses, you know? And that day I had two, and they said, keep them out of your world. And I tried to push, you know, try to push them away, stand in front of them. They come in behind me, and I was getting freaking upset. I mean, bad. And so it went on for a few minutes, you know, and then they halted it, and they wanted to make sure that I understood. They said, you can use anything in this arena, any tool you want in this arena to keep them out. So I was just looking around, and I see one of these pool noodles. So I grabbed one, and all I had to do was hold that out in front of me, and the horses wouldn't go by it. They wouldn't go through it. And so I could just stand there and do a circle and they would stay outside of my world. And that was the beginning of, yes, use the tools that you have around you. Use the tools that they give you. You don't have to you can't do it all by brute force. You can't do it all by blowing everything up.
We're talking about veterans' mental health with John Serafin, retired Army veteran of 29 years, and his former equine specialist, Tony Mattson, owner and program director at Trinity Equestrian Center in Eau Claire. Tony, we just heard John's amazing experience there. A slow path, but an amazing path. How many people, how common is it to watch that transition from barely being able to trust that horse to start trying to learn those lessons from it?
It's always different for every single veteran always different. And that's something that we just came to realize and know. But once they have that little nugget, that moment, like John described so beautifully, we recognize that instantly because we're watching for that every moment. And when that happens, we know that's the beginning of progress. And so we shift into a whole nother gear when we see that. We can't push to begin with. We have to let it happen absolutely organically between the veteran and the horse. I can't even explain to you the feeling and just the euphoria that comes over us because we know that's the beginning of this amazing transformation that we just started, this journey. And it's not linear. It's never linear. John will tell you how many times that, you know, it's two steps forward, three back, then two to the left, three to the right. But like John said, that's when the work starts. That's when you have to just say, okay, I'm in this. I don't want to take my life. I want to fight through this. And we do our best to give them every tool that they're going to need in order to be successful. And it is, it's the best work I've ever done in my life.
John, something else that amazes me about your story is not only did you go through this program, you made the decision that you want to help other people through it. Now you're a board member at Trinity Equestrian Center. What made you want to take that next step to where you were helping not just yourself, but other people coming through the same situation?
Well, like I said, I grew up in the Army. And so back in the old days, that's how you were taught to look behind you and to pull them forward. You know, watch out for everybody. And so when I went through the program, I could never repay Trinity, Tony, or Sylvia for what they've given me, giving me back my life. I still have bad days. It ain't over. But I have a lot more good days than bad days now. And so I've tried in different aspects to give back to Trinity. I was a liaison for Trinity, a position we were trying to lay out. And like I'd go in to different places and talk and stuff like that, and I still will. But I was in one time, I was in with a veteran, and I would almost decipher the language because we have our own language in the military, a lot of acronyms. But things that how we talk to each other, I can go on any military base and talk. I always felt at home on any military base. So I would try to bridge that gap between the civilians and the military on the language. And this individual was involved in an explosion, and I was. And just when I think, oh, I got a handle on this, I'm driving a bus and all that. Well, I went home and I woke up that night and I was in a cold sweat and I had nightmares. When you have nightmares like that and you're sober, sometimes I'm just afraid to go back to sleep. And so I just stay up. Well, that told me right there, and I talked to Tony, and I said, well, I can't do this. You know, I'm not ready for this. And so we just left it alone, but I've always wanted to get back. And so this last spring, you know, they approached me and asked me if I'd be a board member, and I've never been so honored. And so now I look at it like, okay, I'm not hands-on with the veterans itself, but I can still help. I can still go out there and help guide the programs and talk and whatever I can do.
John, something I'm so thankful for is as dark as things have been for you, it sounds like you kept being willing to seek help. And when one kind didn't work, you tried another, and eventually you found the equine therapy. Can you talk directly maybe to somebody who's listening who's where you were but maybe not ready to seek help? What would you say to them?
Just keep fighting every single day. Don't give up. Equine therapy is not for everybody. I wish it was. And I had it take me a little bit to get that because it worked for me. So I think, it could work for everybody. But it's not for everybody. So just keep finding something. Something is out there to help. Just keep fighting the fight and know that there's other programs out there. There's other people out there reaching behind us to get you back across the wire.
And Tony, for people listening who think, hey, I'm in a position as a veteran maybe who could benefit from this, maybe equine therapy is right for me, how do they get involved in this?
They can certainly go to our website, trinity-ec.com, and there's contact info there. You can just email us and say, hey, but I do love what John just said is that, you know, equine therapy is not for everybody, but there is something out there that can help. My big thing is find your fit and grab onto it with both hands. Don't let it go until you are on a smooth, straight path, whether it's gardening or art or canine therapy, or I don't care what it is, anything that resonates with you that gives you that inspiration to, like John says, fight, keep fighting. That's what they need to go after. But if they're in our area, absolutely come our way. And honestly, if they're listening to this and they're, you know, too far to drive, get a hold of me. I've got an entire resource across the country of equine therapy places that work with veterans, and I can't even think of one that charges. We don't charge. We never will charge for any of our veteran program work, and it serves the veteran as well as the family. I also have an entire resource I put together, not equine therapy, lots of other things. So, like I say, my big thing is let's help you find your fit.
Oh, we'll leave it there. Tony, thanks for the work you're doing, and thanks for sharing it with us.
Absolutely, our pleasure. And thank you to all the veterans out there, not just today, but always, all days.
And John, thank you so much for sharing your story, and we're all pulling for you over here.
Thank you, sir, and thank you for having an interest in this.
John Serafin is a retired Army veteran of 29 years from Wisconsin who experienced benefits through equine therapy. Tony Mattson is co-founder, owner, and program director at Trinity Equestrian Center in Eau Claire. They talked with Rob Ferret yesterday. Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a 2004 Buick Century for $7,000 helped lift a Milwaukee teen out of poverty and start a career.
Getting that car gave me independence. It gave me power. It allowed me to reach so much further.
The author of Mechanic Shop Femme's Guide to Car Ownership is next from WPR. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Did your first car give you independence? My 85 Chevy Nova absolutely did. In its final days, it moved me from Philadelphia to Minneapolis for my first real job. Broke down in Akron, Ohio, but a good mechanic got us back on the road. For Kaya Milstein of Milwaukee, her first car was the difference between landing her first job or risking homelessness after aging out of foster care. Since then, Milstein has built a career as an automotive educator, social media influencer, and founder of Mechanic Shop Femme. Her new book for buying and maintaining a car is called Mechanic Shop Femme's Guide to Car Ownership. Kaya, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with your first car, the 2004 Buick Century, purchased for $7,000 out the door. Can you explain how it changed your life, this first car you bought?
You know, I had no intention of learning how to drive. As a foster kid, you are actually prohibited from getting a driver's license in most circumstances because of liability issues and the way the state laws are written and so forth. So it wasn't something I did. And then I got this job at Sears Auto Center, this job in a career that I had no idea about. And they said, well, do you have a driver's license? And I'm like, no. So I had to go get a driver's license. And then I had to get a car because now I had three part-time jobs. You need a car to get around in Wisconsin, right?
Yeah.
So I started the process by talking to people online and, you know, trying to get as much information as possible. And I went to Educators Credit Union and I said, hey, I don't have a job yet, but I have two job offer letters. I don't have a cosigner. I have virtually no credit, but here's my job offer letters. If I get this car, I can start working. And they gave me a car loan for this 2004 Buick Century. Man, it was like a boat, big, clunky car. And getting that car gave me independence. It gave me power. It allowed me to reach so much further than I could have ever expected. And even though I only had it for a few months before it was totaled, it still has that big impact.
I thought it was so interesting how you say that a carefully purchased car, a solid mechanic, and education can help propel someone out of poverty. What is so transformative about that equation?
I think a lot of people, when they think of a car, think of a luxury, something extra, something you don't need, something you only get if you have enough money for everything else in your life. But in America, in most of this country, having a car means you can take more jobs. Having a car means that you can rest between your jobs. I think people don't realize how long it takes to take a bus somewhere, especially if you have to take that bus several places over that time. If you can cut out all of that time and you can spend that time and focus on rest, having a car allows you to do that. Having a good car gives you the opportunity to get a leg up, to get more opportunities, to have more possibilities in front of you. However, buying the wrong car, spending your entire life savings on a car that has problems that you didn't know about, that can make you sink a lot further down in the hole. And I think when I was going to buy that first car and when I was getting advice from the people in my life, they were all extremely nervous about the fact that I was going to purchase a car and I was going to spend my money on this. I was going to take out a loan because they've seen so many other people fail miserably by buying a car with problems.
There's a risk involved.
Right. And those problems end up costing more than the car, or those problems are impossible to fix because now you've spent all your money on the car. So I really truly believe that it's not just buying a car, it's buying the right car, the one that fits your needs, the one that fits your budget, the one that is in as best condition as it can be. And if there are things wrong with it, that you are as prepared as you could be for them.
As I hear you talk, you've noted how you've carved out this unique role for yourself as a mechanic interpreter, translating some specialized car information for people and kind of being that wing person. Can you describe your role as you see it in cars?
The automotive industry is such an interesting place for people to interact with, especially women and queer folks and poor people and people of marginalized identities. When you walk into a repair shop, you're walking into a different world. You're walking into a place where a lot of times people don't have the fundamental respect for you, your communities, your life, who you are. For the sake of the industry and for the sake of its customers, change has to happen. And what I see as sort of my place in this is I'm not fixing anybody's car. I am trying to equip car owners with the fundamental knowledge about car ownership. When we talked about buying a car, and that just covers the first two chapters of the book. My goal is to share all of the fundamental elements to teach you how to find that good mechanic and how to talk with them and how to vet them and how to communicate and how to build a relationship, so that my book is just the starting place. I'm helping you build the foundation of the knowledge that so many people weren't taught. I can never forget when I started making TikToks, a young man left a comment on my video and he said something to the effect of, "Thank you for teaching me about cars. My parents were too worried about trying to make me not gay to teach me basic life skills." Mm. And I think that kind of sums it up. I'm trying to teach people the things that their parents should have taught them. I'm trying to teach people the things that mechanics should explain to them, but often don't have the time or the communication skills to get that information to them. And I'm also trying to empower them to ask the questions, to know what to do, to have the backups, and to trust themselves, to trust their gut, and learn to trust the mechanic after a period of time, the one that they've built that relationship with. And that whole package together, the car, the mechanic, the book, the knowledge, the education, the empowerment, all of that together, that makes for a much better experience walking into a repair shop or a dealership and owning a car in general.
We're talking with automotive educator and influencer Kaya Milstein about her new book, Mechanic Shop Femme's Guide to Car Ownership, and her approach to caring for cars and keeping them up. So you walk into a dealership and immediately a salesperson is in your face, perhaps making some assumptions about you. How do you prepare yourself to deal with the pushy, perhaps, salespeople in that environment?
Absolutely. Walking into a dealership, you're dealing with people that are car professionals. They are professional salespeople. They're professional negotiators. It is their job to get as much money from you as possible. That doesn't necessarily make them bad people, and they might be very, very helpful. But you never know what you're dealing with when you're walking in, and you don't know who you're dealing with. And based on my experiences and so many other people, countless people that I talk to on a regular basis, walking into the dealership is scary. The way that people are treated at the dealership can be very frustrating and very angry. Even if the car buying process itself is smooth, the way that people can be treated because of their gender, sexuality, or life circumstances always makes things more complicated. So what I always say is that you should learn as much as you can before you walk into the dealership. You should know the answers to nearly every question you have before you walk in the door. Today, you can do everything except for test driving at the car outside of the dealership. You can figure out what your needs and your budget are. You can figure out monthly payments based on your budget and interest rates. You can figure out what the best cars are by doing research on places like Consumer Reports and getting more information and looking at cars that are similar that might also meet your needs. You can do your research about the specific car that you're going to walk into and look at. Look at the history of the vehicle. Look at all the details. Go through the pictures. If you have any questions about the car buying process, research those questions before you walk in so that you are as prepared and educated as possible to advocate for yourself.
And then it's time for going on a test drive. And I was a bit surprised by how long you think a test drive should take. What is the ideal test drive?
I think a test drive should take 15 to 30 minutes minimum.
Wow.
When you're test driving a vehicle, you aren't just making sure that your body fits in the car. You want to make sure that the car runs and drives and behaves the way that you would expect it to. But you also want to make sure that the car is a fit for your needs. One example that I give frequently is people who drive who are thinking about buying a Subaru, and they've previously driven a Jeep or a truck or something along those lines. And if they've never driven a Subaru before and they get into the Subaru and they start driving, they will feel immediately discombobulated because Subarus are very responsive. You sort of touch the steering wheel, the car goes which way you tell it to. You tap the brakes, the car stops. You need to drive the car to figure out if it's a fit for you. You need to drive the car so that you can listen to it, especially the older and the more miles the car has, to see if there's anything that sticks out to you, any red flags. You need to take it through its paces on the highway and on the regular road, because what if a problem doesn't happen until you hit 50 miles an hour, right?
Yeah. Well, let's do one MythBuster here. Winterizing here in Wisconsin, winter upon us, snow potential. What do you recommend when it comes to, air quotes here, winterizing your car and driving in the snow?
Winterizing is kind of a misnomer. It is not something that really exists. People will sell you winterizing services. Usually they mean replacing the coolant and replacing the thermostat. And cars today don't need that to be done every single year. In fact, most cars don't need to replace the coolant for 50 to 100,000 miles, let alone every 12 to 15,000 miles, which is the average driving an American is doing in their car. If you take care of your car regularly, if you maintain it, you take it in for service, you do everything that your owner's manual says, there isn't a whole lot more you have to do to prepare for winter. Now, of course, there's some things that you might want to take extra into consideration, making sure your tires are not worn past the point where it makes sense to drive them in the snow, making sure you put new wiper blades on your car so that you can clear your windshield when you're in those situations, making sure your brakes are in the position that they should be, making sure you have washer fluid that is conducive to the climate and not just the cheapest washer fluid at the grocery store or the gas station, because those aren't always graded for winter weather and they can freeze in your washer fluid reservoir. So if you haven't maintained your car, if you haven't gone to the mechanic recently, going in, getting the car checked out, getting an oil change, a once-over, a multi-point inspection, definitely a good place to start. And then figuring out from the list they give you of things you need, what is the priority? What has to be done now? What could, you know, what's maintenance? And maybe you have to wait for a few paychecks before you can handle it, and what you need to do next.
When I read your guidebook, I promptly closed it and went out to the car to see if I could find the owner's manual. Never looked for it in the glove box, really, never paid attention to it. Why should we know our owner's manual?
One of the most common things I get from like haters or trolls on social media is they tell me, you can find everything that you're talking about in your owner's manual. And I say, yeah, I have a whole chapter about the owner's manual. I agree. There's a whole lot you can learn in your owner's manual. But here's the thing. If you never open up the owner's manual, you're not going to learn anything. Your owner's manual is full of information to help you be a better car owner. The most important elements that I think are the maintenance schedule. When you should do what services, how often, at what mileage or what age you should do, how often you should change your oil, your spark plugs, your timing belt, your coolant, all of those things that you sometimes go and ask the internet or ask your friends and get such a wide array of answers. Your owner's manual will tell you what your car actually needs. It's going to tell you all kinds of other stuff, warranty, how to turn buttons on, how to, what different dash lights on. It is so full of information. And I know that the book itself can be very intimidating, especially if it's piled under a bunch of junk in your glove box or maybe doesn't exist, like in your case. You can find a digital version of your owner's manual online. And if you are tech savvy, you can press Control F and you can search the owner's manual for what you're specifically looking for as you start to learn more about your car and what's in it.
Kaya, it's so good to talk with you. Thank you so much for the tips. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me here.
That was automotive educator and influencer Kaya Milstein offering stories and advice from her new book, Mechanic Shop Femme's Guide to Car Ownership. Get in touch with us. Share your story about your car experiences at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. We've been checking in on local food pantries around the state and the efforts to make sure that neighbors in our communities can enjoy special holiday meals. And we'd like to hear from you. Do you take part in a local food drive? Do you box up meals for a local food pantry? What is it like to be a volunteer now? Or what is it like to rely on a food pantry in difficult times? You can reach out to us. Share your story by leaving a message or texting us now at 888-642-0232 or email about your local food pantry and anti-hunger efforts at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. And we always appreciate hearing from you and learning about what you're involved with in your community. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.